Now, this is a continuation of the discussion. It's not a lecture, it's a discussion, a very general discussion of Poor Richard in Thoreau, the first part of Walden, Economy. The date of this old cassette, I don't know. I'm transferring it and clearing up the cassette in May 69, and this is Channel 2 Right. This is Channel 2 Right, and a continuation of this general discussion of Poor Richard in the first part of Walden. As Carl Van Dorn says, I'll tell you what he says in a minute. Now, he has several little comments here on clothing and shelter and all like that, remember? And I kept, every time I look at it, I say, well, why is he going into this? Well, it's for two. He's thinking about what he will need to stay at Walden. You'll have to have some sort of clothes, some sort of shelter. And then he's raising the question of what a person actually needs. Trying to think independently of it, I'd say. And this is one of the... he says this is the expense of the Concord farmers. He does this a number of times. This is on shelter. When I consider my neighbors, the farmers of Concord, who are at least as well off as the other classes, I find that for the most part, they've been toiling 20, 30, 40 years, that they may become the real owners of their farms, which commonly they have inherited with encumbrances and debt, you know, or else bought with hired money. And we may regard one-third of that toil as the cost of their houses. But commonly, they've not paid for them yet. It is true. Now, there's the... I am, on applying to the assessors, I am surprised to learn that they cannot at once name a dozen in the town who own their own farms. You see? Free. So they are in debt, too. Yes, yes, that's right, interesting. Granted that the majority are able at last even to own or hire the modern house with all its improvements. Granted that they are able to do that, you know. And if the civilized man's pursuits are no worthier than the savage and so on. Yes, now there's in the shelter and the house, that's where he gets into property again, you see. Somebody gave him a little desk piece, and I had three pieces of limestone on my desk, but I was terrified to find that they required to be dusted daily. And then you get to the famous passage, you know, near the end of March, 1845, I borrowed an axe and went down to the woods by Walden Farm, nearest to where I intended to build my house. Now this is such a marvelous passage. The person almost loses his critical sense. He quits. He just follows Thoreau in this. Now let me ask you this. Now he builds his house, and then you see over there where he has the list of the expenses: board so much, shingles so much, lathing so much. Now, why does he put that in? When I see it there, I think now this is tedious, the sort of picayunish that he'd put in something like that. His expense account. He doesn't need to go and itemize all those things. Now, do you see any good reason why he should put that in? I'll turn it over in your mind just a minute. Or look at what he says. He says why he puts it in. He's making the point again. Houses cost so much, but he gets he simplified his to this point. Yes, sir.
He says that he intends to build a house that will surpass any on the Main Street Conference.
Let me read you one passage that you haven't mentioned. The exact cost of my house, paying the usual price for such materials as I used, but not counting the work, all of which was done by myself, was as follows. Now look, and I give the details because very few are able to tell exactly what their houses cost. Now, in that one little statement, he has challenged Franklin on his own ground as Poor Richard. Franklin says the most important thing, and it's even important for women, girls, is order to keep accounts. And that's where he fails the most. Thoreau says it is an important thing, and that's where he excels. He keeps accounts, and furthermore, he knows how much his house costs. So that, in a way, he clashes consciously with Franklin as Poor Richard. And it's not over any great spiritual point. Just about ordinary, everyday economy, economics. Now, you remember the passage just before this where he says, I have spent a great deal of time, what did he say? I've always endeavored to acquire strict business habits. I didn't know it was late. I didn't have any idea of what we were going to do when I came in here. Could you shift your attitude to Thoreau, towards Thoreau, in this way? That in point of business dealings, economy, business habits, he challenges Franklin. And that this underlies Walden. Now, I'll tell you what. You go on from here, and let's see what turns up in the discussion next time. And I think I had better just let you take your time. And then on Friday, I think you'll have plenty of time by Friday. I can give you another one of those little tests, and this last one was a good one. That's the end of this little tape on the discussion. A whole time, a whole hour discussion of Poor Richard in Economy, the first part of Walden. The date of it, I don't know. I'm transferring it in May 69, and this is 95, Channel 2 Right. Channel 2 Right, 95. Channel 2 Right, 95. Poor Richard in Walden. Just a class discussion. Now, this is that go over the test today, that big test from Friday the 2nd of May, and this is Monday the 5th of May. I go over all that fine material, and at the end, I get into poll. But it was a pretty fair test, and I invited them to answer the questions home, turn them in on Monday, and a good many of them did. I had them there on my desk, and they were getting into the material. And as I remember, that day was the first time everybody sort of looked at me like we were all human beings. Oh, that's noticeable. So this is channel 2 right around 105, channel 2 right around 105, and this tape is from Monday the 5th of May, 69. I first go over the questions on that test and try to reinforce, work out, and simplify that Emersonian influence, the part that enables me to interpret the Scarlet Letter. One thing, in a group like this, I think of the class as the heart of the matter. Enables us to cut through a whole lot of deadwood. But we don't stay with the material long enough to see to work it out and sometimes actually get a clear feel of it. So this simply has to run into where you talk amongst yourselves. And it just makes me lose sleep at night to think about people taking a class and that's all there is to it. And they go home and shut up with a book and that's the end of it. All those books are deadly, I think. I think they come to life, you see, when you got someone talking about them. If you, that might be one of the first things you ought to do. And a crowd like this ought to, look around, find somebody at least you could have a cup of coffee with. You don't have to talk. I don't know where I learned this, but you don't have to just talk forever in order to say something. I've had to school myself to where I talk. I think 5 minutes of anybody's time is just prolific, prodigal. I'd just be happy, you see. Sometimes all I get is walk down the hall and I'll meet one of these learned professors. And I might just bring up something, and if they let fall a crumb, I'm happy to have it. And I'll take it home and make a meal of it. That's true. I overstated, but it's true. I go just from little suggestions, and charmed, delighted, feel thankful just to get them from various people. Notes on this. This is on the notes I made over the weekend. Sort of a new direction to go in here. Emerson takes you. He's pretty mental, you know. And you still have to live amongst your neighbors. And I think Thoreau is a little closer to the neighbors than Emerson is. Now, what I'd like to do, you can sort of spearhead this. Give me a little help on this so I can make some recommendations. I say you can come out and see Ms. Van Arnim and me, or I'll go somewhere else, and make it a kind of a Thoreau expedition and report on it. And the idea that you have to report on it will focus your attention and make you look for something. And that'll, if you look for something, you'll see something, you know. That's one of the things I got out of nature study. I did a little one time. I was older than Emerson when I did that, way younger. But I heard people, I could see people who knew the plants and the birds and all like that. And I just could hear the bird songs and knew which bird it was. And you know, I got so it's embarrassing to me. I couldn't do that. And still I talk about nature. A nephew of mine, he must have been 12 years old when he started that. And he got so he could see hawks just at a great distance and tell you what the hawk was and what he was doing. A hawk. I've never got that good. An owl. Now, I've had neighbors out there amongst the owls since I've been there, and I still don't know what kind they are. I don't care. I know their voices, and I know when they come up there close to the house and have a family feud every night. I know that. Oh, they do get upset at each other. And just talk an awful way. Remember, I was used to living out at Gulfview, and at that time there were families of owls out there. And I heard one of the neighbors one time say, it's just awful to have all this racket at night. Isn't that awful? Anyone think that way about it? This awful. This neighbors with the chewers. Well, now what I was going to say to you about Thoreau. Well, now to think about Thoreau, you see, Thoreau himself, there's a sort of tension there. I never realized that quite until I got to thinking about it. You see, he can write about the loon and the red ant and the others, the red squirrel and the black ant, because he knows so much about them. He's observed them. He's lived with them. You might say they're his neighbors. But you see, if he knows too much about them, he can't write about them. He loses the interest that interests us. So he realized that. There's a line between knowing too much and that's, you know, we usually call that scientific. Scientific people are usually very dull, but, you know, except to themselves, amongst themselves. They lose the touch. I always did. Now, I thought about divide and throw. Say if we read them again, not read them all in one, just in one big beat. Make two or three little beats. Well, you see, I don't know how to do that. The first 50 pages is Franklin, just his reaction to Franklin, poor Richard. And then, and also, then he, I don't know what he does next. It seems to me like that next stretch, he's still a sort of Chanticleer, keeping his neighbors awake. He's still that polemic, has that polemic view, and says things to annoy people. When he's talking about solitude and all those subjects. Now, I don't know where it is. You see, his portraits are, now forget how it's divided, but it seems to me like John Field and the loon and those things come in the last part of it. So if you'd say, well, read the first half, you won't get the part, some of the parts you need. So it's kind of hard. I realize you might be able to work that out for me. You're in it. I could take a few chapters here and a few there or some such thing. I don't know, there's so much more to Thoreau now. That's that public function of the scholar, you might say, in Thoreau, where he talks about, keeping the, he can be like Chanticleer and irritate his neighbors, keep them awake, wake them up. Now there's so much more to Thoreau. Yeah. Now you see, there's one thing that Thoreau does. Emerson talks about it, but Thoreau doesn't. Emerson has no experience at all. He theorizes on it, but Thoreau is the one that has the experience. Now, it depends on what you want to read. Just pure theory or experience mixed with a strong dose of theory in it. Now, talking about experience, you see, that makes you think of Poe. How would you say Poe fits into that Emersonian point on the education of the scholar, where the scholar has to live? And you meet a man and let him talk 5 minutes, and you can tell how much he's lived. How's that work with Poe? Most of us, look at that stuff there. That's not experience. Nobody ever did anything like that. Not in live to tell it. And look at that Ligeia stuff that he puts in. It's just frightful. And he'd use such stuff as that. And even the black cat, he gets from an ordinary cat to a supernatural cat. And I don't, for no particular reason. And I can't think of any reason why coal should stay in the curriculum of the public schools. Seems like all the influence he has is bad. Just establishes bad reading habits, bad standards, and they like the wrong thing. And then they have to live above them or live them down, and you see they never have time to do that. So they carry over those perverse things from school. What you want to do, you see, when you examine a question, you want to make a strong statement and then examine it. See, that's no strong one Emerson made. Whoso would be a man must be a nonconformist. He don't necessarily have to be. And then he pursues that with the fruits of nonconformity. He who would gather mortal palms must not be hindered by the name of goodness, but must inquire if it be goodness. And unless the mind is freed from society, there is no inquiry. So there's no fruits of nonconformity. So, well, you see now, in Dimmesdale, the fruit of his nonconformity. Would you grant him that nonconformity? Dimmesdale? Well, you have to, because he left the forest scene and he didn't do it, but if it hadn't been Hawthorne handling it, he would have, of taunting the people, you see, and about their conformity, and telling each one of them, you see, all this rubbish about this, that, and the other, of the institution. In other words, he's freed, he's momentarily release from the institution. And he gives him that release, feeling of release. And that goes over into the election sermon. So that election sermon is, you might say, the fruit of nonconformity. Although we still haven't said what the content of it is. You see how you can pick that up and use it. I've experienced. For one thing, as we've said this, it'll separate Emerson and Thoreau. Emerson doesn't put any experience in here. And Thoreau has all that rich experience in the education. He calls it education, into the makeup of the scholar. Yeah. Put it into the essay. Emerson. Well, now look. Now you see how you can carry this out? It gives you terms in which to think. You know, I hate to pass up Emerson altogether. It gives you time for to think. Knowledge is cheap, and knowledge is dull, and knowledge is just, I'd rather gossip about my neighbors and just sit there and talk about knowledge, just plain knowledge, unformed by thought. Now, you see, Emerson's categories, thought, Emerson gives you the terms. He gives you the terms, but you have to have these other writers to fill it out, I think. Of Hawthorne's is so extraordinary, just so extraordinary. You see, it's not Puritan in any moral sense. It's such an elevated sense. So you see, I can't test you on that, something I don't know, and something is certainly beyond your experience. So all I can do is just sort of stay down at the base of the statue amongst the peripheral things. And those two points that I asked you to cover are more or less mechanical. In both Hester and Dimmesdale, you got that basic Emerson, position from Emerson and Thoreau, that their vision has to be cleared by clashing with society. Society, you see, in their view, is nothing but shows and appearances. Nothing. No reality to society. Now, he doesn't overthrow society. He lives within it, you see. Thoreau actually did. Emerson did. No one can avoid that. But you're talking about his mental view of the world. So then both of them give you the fruits of that freedom of the minister, the fruits of the freedom. The first fruits, you see, is that he wants to, well, in that chapter, minister to me and Hester. Well, now we've covered the test. When you're exposed to such entails this, this is a sort of a lifetime thing. You sort of carry this with you. And you see, I don't intend to grade you any great extent. And you can wrestle with this or not. It's entirely up to you that you are under no compulsion whatsoever to carry this thought. You'll have enough lecture notes in here to carry you through, and I don't think anyone should feel embarrassed or nervous or anything of the sort about it. I've been in courses where I had no idea what was going on, and still I made a C. Yes, and I don't think instructors should be compelled to hold a course down to the C quality of work, so that everybody will feel at home. Yes. Yeah, it's like Thoreau's house pulling it down there. Yeah.
Him leaning on it leaned on him.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Well, in my view, you'd enjoy yourself more if you had that. Just a sort of a twist, Now you see, I think you see, for one thing, in this sort of thought, I think you can see any institution better. I think the assumption is that anyone goes to university understands university. I think that's extraordinarily. I don't think the error could be any more basic, any more fundamental than that. This university is colossal thing, and you've got people here of huge intellect, and the organization of the place is awesome. Any quick statement about the university, but now from Emerson's point of view is, you see, the university can defeat its own purpose. Take the lecture system. Now you see, I'd take the position of doubt and say that the lecture system just compounds error. You don't understand the writer. All you do is understand a few statements about the writer in literature. But one has a fallacious notion. That is, he's fooled himself into thinking that he has made contact with the writer. Now, you can make statements like that, and the president won't be mad at you, or the deans, or the department heads, or the professors. I mean, everybody realizes that there is a basic weakness, you see, and then students get in a tight spot, and they play the system, and exercise all sorts of duplicity. One of my friends in summer, older, taught, came back, and she happened to be in my class, and it happened to be one of the finest classes I've had, partly because she was in it. And she was just, her faith in the system had almost shattered. She saw such duplicity among the students. Just working the system, you see, just like a bunch of soldiers out working the army. You know, one of my old friends in the army, he was a doctor, and he found out how to work the system, and before he got overseas, where I went over with him, he had a trunk full of PX supplies. He had razor blades, toothpaste, and chocolate bar that he had got. because he knew how to work the system. He didn't need it all. It just seemed to be some pleasure. Well, you can work the academic system the same way. I think the point is to use it, you know. Use it for what value it has. And when I think of some of the lectures here, I don't want to throw off on the lectures, you know. When I think of some of those marvelous lectures here that I miss that go on every day, it hurts me. I need to hear what they say. But basically, I think we suffer from the lectures. Now, what do you want to talk about? You didn't want to talk about that. Hold the manuscript found the bottle if I can find the manuscript. If I can find the bottle. A long time I tried to make sense of this, and all it did was just batter my brain, you see, because there's no sense in it. And but it took me a long time to realize that. Oh, you've got a lot of Poe ingredients, but it doesn't hold together. I don't know how to talk about it. How would you say that? The beginning of it is sort of Newton. He does obeisance here. He nods in the direction here of the physical world, physical science. You see, of the 18th century, Newton and the laws of the universe. Don't you know, he says, beyond all things, the works of the German moralists gave me great delight, the moralists, not from any ill-advised admiration of their eloquent madness, but from the ease with which my habits of rigid thoughts enable me to detect their fallacies. I have often been reproached with the aridity of my genius, a deficiency of imagination. You see, so far you haven't got anywhere. A deficiency of imagination has been imputed to me as a crime, and the Pyrrhonism of my opinion has at all times rendered me notorious. Now, what Poe's doing here is just spreading it pretty thick. You see, as a youngster, he tend to do that. Indeed, a strong relish for physical philosophy has, I fear, physical philosophy means science, has, I fear, tinctured my mind with a very common error of this age. I mean the habit of referring to common occurrences, even the least susceptible of such reference, to the principle of that science. Upon the whole, no person could be less liable than myself to be led away in the era of superstition, because he has a scientific mind. Now, he says that to vouch, you see, for this preposterous story, that it's going to... Isn't that curious? He has this, after next paragraph, after many years spent in foreign travel, I sailed in this year from there to there, having no other inducement than a kind of nervous restlessness which haunted me as a fiend. Well, you see, he takes back what he just said. He's got no scientific mentality or personality either. This is much more like it. Now, where does he get this nervous restlessness? Well, he can get it from those German moralists he's talking about up there. Where could he get it, this nervous restlessness? Huh? From these, yes. From Byron was one of the chief sources of it. Byron tainted everybody, you see. Right? Well, it was a little more than romantic. It was an extreme. Shelley wasn't nervous. Wordsworth wasn't nervous. What are you talking about? No. But there's a strong element of it. I think the Byronic side of it would pass, and the Germans had a good, strong bit of it. See, Ancient Mariner had it. Coleridge didn't, but the Ancient Mariner did. And the Mariner's in here. Well, now, where are we? You see? One evening, leaning over the something or other, I observed a very singular isolated cloud. It was remarkable as well from its color as from its being the first we had seen since our departure from Batavia. Now, he learned this from Defoe. Defoe, you see, is going to give you a circumstantial account of what happened. Now, here this little cloud starts out there. It looks like a scientific account, or what a sailor might say. But look at what that cloud amounts to pretty soon. See it grow? Well, maybe they grow like that. It's tornado. Yes, monster. Don't forget that road to Damascus. Extreme furious blast proved, in the great measure, the salvation of the ship. And the sun rose with a sickly yellow luster and clambered a very few degrees above it, you see, in 5 entire days. Now, Poe is a master at this. He's a master at this narrative. He really is. And you know, now let me see. And now you see every mountain billow, every mountainous billow hurried to overwhelm us, to swell surpass, the swell surpassed anything I had imagined. You know where they're going? There's only one place they could go then. He'd go in the same place Ancient Mariner went. Well, now don't just volunteer and tell me about Ancient Mariner went. Yeah. Because it hadn't been down there, and not much known about it. But they had intimations, you see, probably down there. See you this night? You know, if you swing along with the rider, not taking so far seriously sometimes. Now, this gigantic ship, I don't know where that comes from, but it's marvelous, isn't it? I think that's cool. I think nobody could get that ship up there on that wave 100 feet high beside Poe. So I say that's one of the Poe ingredients. Now, look here. I'll tell you, the astronauts ought to know how to do this. There he is. He shifts over that other ship. And look at that ship. Now, do you know where that ship comes from? It's perfectly obvious where that ship comes from. Yes, sir. That's one of Francis Drake's ships. It's a little old now. He's talking about all that oak and stuff. I forget the details of it. It's soaked, you see. These are Drake's old sailors. They're a little aged. Why he resurrects them, I don't know. And you see, he's got that word discovery over there. I have made my observations lately upon the structure of the vessel, although well armed she is not, I think, a ship of war. Well, that's nice. Now, you know, I haven't read this in some time, and I kind of forget it. There's some little feeling here. They don't speak. I don't know why he makes them so speechless. No. Yes. Let's go through. Let's see how much we have in the time. Or do we? Well, let me tell you. Let's polish off this other one. Which one did I say? Such a finished story. Now, you see, in this, he makes his statement, what I call his statement, his proposition. He works it out, and at the end he says, this is what I started to show you. Now, this is scientific in its organization. It has a logical organization. And what he's studying here is the thing. Now, here is one of the curious things. A person won't see this in Poe. I think what he sees, as you see, when I say what anyone sees who reads it, you see that's pretty hypothetical. But I think the feeling is that Poe is in his story. Now, he's not in this story. Revenge, I don't think Poe ever wanted to get revenge. I just can't imagine wanting to get revenge. Certainly not this kind of revenge. It is such an extreme form of revenge that it's almost, now that I'm familiar with it, I feel that what Poe is saying, that people let themselves in for these sentiments of revenge and allow themselves to have vengeful thoughts, and here he's going to show you what an awful thing it is to have vengeful thoughts. In other words, he's a moralist. All writers are, naturally.
It's such an awful thing that a man does. The sorrows and injuries of Fortunato I had borne as best I could. But when he ventured upon insult, I vowed revenge. All those injuries he suffered. But he can't stand insult. Now, one of the nice things about this is he goes back, you see, one of the favorite Shakespeare plays was Richard the Witch, the one that can't stand insult. Don't you know? Which one of Richard is that? Richard the... You know, I haven't read him so long. One of the Richards. One of those awful Richards, you see? You who know my soul too well, not suppose how I gave utterance to a threat. At length, that would be arranged. See, so it's premeditated. He has a genius for this, you see. This was a point definitely to settle on, but the very definiteness with which it was resolved precluded the idea of risk. So, in a way, he almost defined his extreme sort of revenge. It's premeditated, and there's no idea of risk. I must not only punish, but punish with impunity. A wrong is unredressed when retribution, yes. And you see that the very last thing that happens in here, the man has to know what he's doing to him. He can't just kill him, but he's got to know. And you see the last thing the man says, what's the other fellow's name? Montresor or something like that. Which is which? Last thing he says, you remember that? Is Fortunato is the one that's been revenged, isn't it? The one that walled up? Yes. And the other is Montresor. The last thing he says, Poe even puts it in italics. So you'll be sure to see it. You see that? For the love of God, you see, he sees what's going on, and even in his mean mind, it's mean. So you see in this, now you can go into the great deal more to it than that, but by and large you see in what consummate control he has, and then he, all the little parts of it, one thing, there's that irony, you see, of insult. You see Montresor insulting, Fortunato insulting, don't you remember that? He lets him insult him a time or two. And then you see Fortunato sort of under control. Strike back. As when he says, you're not a Mason? You're not a Mason. It insults him. Well, I thought, let me tell you, I don't want to spend much time on Poe. I think we ought to do a little. He's such a favorite. People just love Poe, you know. While he keeps them awake at night, they're still just fond of Poe. I want to read one or two of the poems with you. Now, time to go. That other one, The Pit and the Pendulum, I think it's an artistic blunder in it that it keeps people from following it. I'll just run through that with you and work up to, I could take several of his better stories. I'd take the two I mentioned to you, Ligeia and The Fall of the House of Usher. They are not clear. His object in them is not clear. And what I suggest to you is that you use that same Emersonian approach. I won't grade you on it, but what I'm saying to you is use it as a means of, you see, of clarifying it. There was one, yes, this comes up. You say, where are we now in regard to Emerson and the Scarlet Letter and all like that? We're far from the end. I don't think, I think your measurement on that should be the state of mind in which this discussion was held in here on that Monday, where we had all this loose ends. None of them made sense. At least we're getting into it now enough to feel as if we're getting somewhere. Although there's a long way to go, I'm aware of that.
You see, this field.
This gets into Poe through that early Poe story, and then to the cask. I'd like to have a tape on the others, on the better ones, and going from that marvelous beginning of the pit and the pendulum, you see, as an indication of what's going to happen in Nigeria. I don't believe I have that tape.
See, that Monday, the 5th of May, 69,
Monday the 5th of May, the 69, when I went over this big jump of getting Emerson into the course, and then showing how little of Emerson we actually got into it, and how much difference it made. And that was Monday, the 5th of May, 69, and this is Channel 2 Right, 575, Channel 2 Right. This is Monday, the 5th of May, 69. It's Channel 2 Right, around 577, 580, Channel 2 Right, around 580. This is on the screw, Wednesday of week 9. The governess as perceptive as Emersonian, and the beginning of her view of her as Freudian. This is Thursday morning. I just talked to Florence, and she has the best view of the Freudian side. I've never been able to get it that closely. I mean, she's persistent, and she keeps it. She studies it. I tape most of this session, all of it, I believe, most of it, Wednesday of the 9th week. That's 28th of May, 69. Wednesday of the 9th week. The 28th of May, 69. This is Channel 2 Right, around 580.
This, you know, you kind of get into this.
You read it as an inquiry on James's part, and then, you see, you can read it as a kind of inquiry, too, and sort of test it as you go along. Yes. When I first read this, I didn't know enough about it to read. I had no background. I had nobody warned me at all what was in it. You could see it. Oh, I just misread it. I was just a great waste. You can test it. You see, with these little touchstones you have, you can see some of the little things in Hester and in Lydia and Ishmael. Thoreau at Walden. Yeah, that would help you, even without a bibliography. Then that would sort of halfway keep you straight, keep you open. I don't know what attitude is proper for getting into a new piece of writing. I don't know just what the proper attitude is. I know I'm mine's wrong. When I get into it, I struggle. I'm fighting with the writer so much of the time. For at least for 100 pages, till I kind of find out what goes on, I just fight it. I don't think anyone else does that. And, see, this story really doesn't have any chance at all for me until I get into it. That's not right, you see. You don't get to spend all that time on everything you read. You've got to have the right attitude to start with. Well, now you kind of test it as you go. I remember one of the boys on the accent program last term was in the office, and he had written a paper on not this, but on some other Henry James, and he said he had it figured out, and he didn't believe what James said. Well, I suppose that's the proper frame of mind for a member of the accent committee. You look ordinarily, you know, with our background, foreground, as Emerson called it. You'd kind of look to see what she pursues. And you see,
see, I gave her one little cue. What she pursues is wrong. She goes off the deep end. You have these little, you see, you can remember all your former errors in reading. At least I can. Mine. You see, I see how I so violently misread Cole in the pendulum. When I was conscious of the pendulum, was that vile pit. He doesn't show you too much of it, and I seem to want to stick my head over there and see a little more. Isn't that awful? It's awful, like some of my neighbors, the way they read. Awful pendulum. You see, he spares you the pit in order to sacrifice you under that pendulum. You suffer. You see, you're looking the wrong thing. It's an artistic blunder on Poe's part. And it takes such an extraordinarily fine reader to survive it and see the man under the pendulum that you won't get many who can do it. Peter Quint. You could just let him steal the show. I suppose in many a case, many a reader who's gone through the turn of the screw, it's Peter Quint's story that they remember. But I don't let me just stand up here and talk. You say something. Critics, like you say, they have the same problems. And you see, they want to think of the governess as suffering from some sort of. Yes. So the critics themselves, you see, aren't conscious of her, of the foreground. Go ahead, the ground that evening, late. She's looking for the master. It's a master she's actually rather expecting or hoping to see. So you can see how her mind was. How does she strike you to start with? How does the governor? I use a little card, as you very well know. Now, what she sees, you see, out. Let's look at that little section. She comes to the place, a little worried, doesn't she? Suspense. Look at this chapter. You see, in the first weeks, the days were long. You know how long the days are in England this time of year? First weeks, the days were long. They often at their finest gave me what I used to call my own hour. The hour when, for my pupils, tea time and bedtime having come and gone, I had before my final retirement a small interval alone. Much as I liked my companions, this hour was the thing in the day I liked most. And I liked it best of all, when as the light faded, or rather I should say, as the day lingered and the last calls of the last bird sounded in the flushed sky from the old trees, I could take a turn into the grounds and enjoy, almost with a sense of property that amused and flattered me, the beauty and dignity of the place. Now, isn't that remarkable? Now, let me ask you, who, unless they just completely read through that little passage, could ever think that the poor little girl is a key study? That's more than any of them have done. Ishmael, of course, he doesn't do this. None of them have done that. Now, I've read some of your little Thoreau papers, and I appreciate them. But I don't know that you have that spirit that she has. Well, you're not Henry James, you understand. I don't mean to be odious. Gee whiz, I'd love to feel like that. If I could just encumber my mind of some of the foolishness that's on it.
to it.
Say, you, yeah, go ahead. That don't matter. Say nothing.
Self-reliance, you have to say that, but dependent on herself to prove something. And on page 28, she says, I scarce know how to put my story into words that shall be a credible picture of my state of mind, but I wasn't these days literally able to find a joy in the extraordinary flight of heroism the occasion demanded of me. I now saw that I had been asked for a service admirable and difficult,
yeah,
and there would be a greatness in letting it be seen, oh, in the right quarter, that I could succeed where many another girl might have failed. And that,
yeah,
was the key. Like, she had a terrible desire to be what she ended up being, as far as her facing the ghosts, even if they were in her mind. She wasn't afraid. She was, in a sense, like Hester. She faced to what for herself was reality, to the pangs that she had to endure.
You know, our minds are so geared to this crummy Philistine notion of perseverance that it keeps the mind from working. You see, as you said that, you were just drawn towards that idea of self-reliance and perseverance. And it's a pagan, not even a pagan, way of thinking, you know?
Well, it's not that I was trying to point out. It was that Hester exhibits the same thing, that she is wanting this, in a sense, to be as heroic as Hester. Maybe she's tied down by the sense of perseverance, whereas Hester has to persevere, and she doesn't. The governess doesn't have to.
Well, use Hester a little bit more as an analogy. You see, Hester's personality and mind were free to the point, you see, and over that period of time, it enabled her, you see, to live a life, a mental life, and not just emotional life.
Yeah.
Then she could make contact with the great spirits of the age, as he said. And they were great spirits. That was Locke and Newton, and people like that. Locke was, his inquiry was what the human mind can know. Boswell. And see, he turned his back on all the traditional knowledge. That's something, you see, the members of your institutions won't do. I'm standing here lecturing you. None of the institutions will turn their back on it. I won't either. I mean, it's hard to do. And she did. They did. So that now, you see, they put the governess in her company.
Governess would fall short, I think. I think the governess would try to imitate and fall short. Because she's on a different... Well, she's in the same idea as Hester, but she's on a different plane. It doesn't seem to me that the governess has the spunk in reality that Hester has. The governess tries to create her own situation, whereas Hester was in her own situation. Like, the governess's attitude toward the children, that's where I saw a great similarity between Hester and the governess, as far as the treatment of the children, the light and the dark, the fall and the spring, something like that. But that could be just James imitating Walker. And that's being analytical.
Well, now you see you're doing right in life. You can consider the artistic side just a little bit more. See, James's medium allows him to get so much closer to the governess than Hawthorne ever gets to the Hester. The picture is much closer and so much more sustained. You never see Hester's mind work. He writes a sort of an essay on her, standing way out from her. Lord help us, she's so real in James, you know, right there in the garden, and tells you what she likes to see about it. And then she turns over to something.
It's an awful shrug later on. Doesn't she say it's a terrible shrug later on, that she doesn't like the garden and light anymore?
Yeah.
That's what I meant when I said the use of light and dark, the fall.
Yeah.
The fall of pro-life in a sense.
Yeah. That's right. What are you going to say?
Well, sometimes I couldn't. I was torn between the thought of thinking that the governess was selfish because she did everything with the children just in a way to please the master, or else if she really did care that much about him. Somehow I didn't really see that she cared that much about him like Hester cared about Pearl.
Well, he kind of motivates her, doesn't he? And that's what she's looking for, to see him turn up out there. She is kind of isolated out there. She needs someone to lean on. It grows. She kind of wishes he'd show up.
I think a thing that points out her self-reliance is the very fact that she took the job.
Don't use that term.
Because, like, you know, I'm sure it wasn't a typical thing in her day and age for a young, inexperienced girl to take a job as governess.
Venturesome? Mm-hmm. You said. Venturesome?
You said it, and I implied it.
What do you say?
Well, that's what I meant,
actually. I don't think she's venturesome. I think she's scared to death there to start with. She's not like Hester at the prison door. I'm just talking with her. I don't know. See, what we're sort of reaching an impasse. I block you and you won't go ahead. You block me and I can't go ahead. Miss Krantz.
Could it be that because she's so young, this is her first experience out in the world on her own without her family to lean on?
Yeah.
And the position she's acquired is not one that would easily be acquired by a girl from her position.
No.
To be responsible for more or less genteel folks as children would be an awful responsibility for someone so young who hasn't had children.
She really got into it, didn't she?
Yeah, she did. I think she was over-impressed with the master because she was so young and there was a country girl and he was a man of the city or of the world and his manners probably she'd never seen anyone like him or talked to anyone.
Yeah.
His dress and mannerism and over-impressed.
At that age, they apparently, they apparently liked to read novels. Don't you remember?
Mm-hmm.
Her papa
yeah.
wouldn't
she
let her read
did.
Novels. Romances, whatever
mm-hmm.
she called them. And when she did get out, she what'd
yeah.
she say? She was looking to be, what's the word? What's the word?
Sure.
That's right. That's one of the first things you learn about, huh? And you keep being reminded of it. So it has to be there for a reason, doesn't it? So I just restated what you said. Adam, you,
see now, when I'm in here with you, and you've read it, you don't fight it. You're not tense. You don't stiffen up. You're not nervous. Now, that's what I can't be by myself. I have to, be with somebody who sort of helped me out. And then I can sort of breathe, and I sort of feel human.
Now, this is the end of Channel 2 Right. I'll continue this on, the ninth week on Wednesday the 28th of May, 69, the end of Channel 2 Right, and the governess as Emersonian.